He must have been one of the guardians she'd grown friendly with during her time at court.
Nah, just up with some friends and wanted to show them around.
He arched an eyebrow as he took in me and Lyssa. He gave a slight nod of acknowledgement.
Princess Dragomir? Guardian Hathaway?
Apparently our reputations preceded us. It was the first time I'd been addressed by my new title. It startled me. It made me feel slightly guilty about betraying the group I'd just become a member of.
This is Dawn, explained Mia. Dawn, the princess has a favor to ask.
She looked meaningfully at Lyssa. Lyssa took a deep breath, and I felt the burning of compulsion magic through our bond as she focused her gaze upon him.
Dawn, she said firmly, give us the keys and codes to the records archives downstairs, and then make sure the cameras in those areas are turned off.
He frowned.
Why would I?
But as her eyes continued to hold his, I could see the compulsion seize him. The lines on his face smoothed into compliance, and I breathed a sigh of relief. Plenty of people were strong enough to resist compulsion, particularly that of ordinary Moroi. Lyssa's was much stronger because of spirit, though you never knew if someone might break through.
Of course,
he said, standing up. He opened a desk drawer and handed Mia a set of keys that she promptly gave to me.
The code is 4312578.
I committed it to memory, and he beckoned us through the all-powerful door. Beyond it, corridors spread in all directions. He pointed to one on our right.
Down there. Take a left at the end, go downstairs 2 flights, and it's the door on the right.
Mia glanced at me to make sure I understood. I nodded, and she turned back to him.
Now make sure the surveillance is off. Take us there, said Lyssa firmly.
Dawn couldn't resist her command, and she and Mia followed him, leaving me on my own. This part of the plan was all on me, and I hurried down the hall. The facility might be lightly staffed, but I could still run into someone, and would have no compulsion to help me talk my way out of trouble. Dawn's directions were spot on, but I still wasn't prepared when I punched in the code and entered the vault. Rows and rows of filing cabinets stretched down a huge hall. I couldn't see the end of it. Drawers were stacked 5 high, and the faint fluorescent lighting and eerie silence gave it all a spooky, almost haunted feel. All the Guardian's information from before the digital age. God only knew how far back these records went. To medieval days in Europe? I suddenly felt daunted and wondered if I could pull this off. I walked to the first cabinet on my left, relieved to see it was labeled AA1, it read. Below it was AA2, and so forth. Oh, dear. It was going to take me several cabinets to even get out of the A's. I was grateful the organization was as simple as alphabetical order, but I now understood why these cabinets went on forever. I had to go back more than 3/4 of the way down the room to get to the T's, and it wasn't until I got to the TA-27 drawer that I found the file for Tarasov Prison. I gasped. The file was thick, filled with all sorts of documents. There were pages on the prison's history and its migration patterns, as well as floor plans for each of its locations. I could hardly believe it. So much information. But what did I need? What would be useful? The answer came quickly. All of it. I shut the drawer and tucked the folder under my arm. Okay, time to get out of here. I turned around and began heading for the exit at a light jog. Now that I had what I needed, the urgency of escape was pressing on me. I was almost there when I heard a soft click and the door opened. I froze as a Dampier I didn't recognize stepped through. He froze as well, clearly astonished, and I took it as a small blessing that he didn't immediately pin me against the wall and start interrogating me.
"You're Rose Hathaway," he said.
Good Lord. Was there anyone who didn't know who I was? I tensed, unsure what to expect now, but spoke as though us meeting here made perfect sense.
So it would seem. Who are you?
Mikhail Tanner,
he said, still puzzled.
What are you doing here?
Running an errand, I said breezily. I indicated the file. The guardian on duty down here needed something.
You're lying, he said.
I'm the guardian on archive duty. If someone needed something, they would have sent me.
Oh, shit. Talk about best-laid plans failing. Yet as I stood there, a strange thought came to me. His appearance wasn't familiar at all. Curly brown hair, average height, late 20s. Pretty good-looking, really. But his name, something about his name.
Miss Karp! I gasped. You're the one! You were involved with Miss Karp!
He stiffened, blue eyes narrowing warily.
What do you know about that?
I swallowed. What I'd done, or tried to do for Dimitri, wasn't without precedent.
You loved her. You went out to kill her after she turned.
Miss Karp had been a teacher of ours a few years ago. She'd been a spirit user, and as the effects of it began to drive her insane, she'd done the only thing she could to save her mind, become a Strigoi. Mikhail, her lover, had done the only thing he'd known to end that evil state. Search for and kill her. It occurred to me that I was standing face to face with the hero of a love story nearly as dramatic as my own.
But you never found her, I said softly. Did you?
He took a long time in answering, his eyes weighing me heavily. I wondered what he was thinking about. Her? His own pain? Or was he analyzing me?
No, he said finally. I had to stop. The guardians needed me more.
He spoke in that calm, controlled way that guardians excelled at. But in his eyes, I saw grief. A grief I more than understood. I hesitated before taking a shot at the only chance I had to not get busted and end up in a jail cell.
I know. I know you have every reason to drag me out of here and turn me in. You should. It's what you're supposed to do. What I'd do, too. But the thing is, this.
I again nodded at the folder.
Well, I'm kind of trying to do what you did. I'm trying to save someone.
He remained quiet. He could probably guess who I meant and assumed save meant kill. If he knew who I was, he'd know who my mentor had been. Few knew about my romantic relationship with Dimitri, but me caring about him would have been a foregone conclusion.
It's futile, you know,
Mikhail said at last. This time his voice cracked a little.
I tried. I tried so hard to find her. But when they disappear, when they don't want to be found...
He shook his head.
There's nothing we can do. I understand why you want to do it. Believe me, I do. But it's impossible. You'll never find him if he doesn't want you to.
I wondered how much I could tell Mikhail.
How much I should. It occurred to me then that if there was anyone else in this world who understood what I was going through, it would be this man. Besides, I didn't have a lot of options here.
The thing is, I think I can find him, I said slowly. He's looking for me.
What?
Mikhail's eyebrows rose.
How do you know?
Because he, sends me letters about it.
That fierce warrior look immediately returned.
If you know this, if you can find him, you should get back up to kill him.
I flinched at those last words and again feared what I had to say next. Would you believe me if I said there was a way to save him?
You mean by destroying him?
I shook my head. No, I mean really save, a way to restore him to his original state.
No,
Mikhail said swiftly.
That's impossible.
It might not be. I know someone who did it, who turned a Strigoi back. Okay, that was a small lie. I didn't actually know the person, but I wasn't going to get into the string of knowing someone who knew someone.
That's impossible,
Mikhail repeated.
Strigoi are dead. Undead. Same difference.
What if there was a chance? I said. What if it could be done? What if Ms. Karp, if Sonya, could become Roy again? What if you could be together again?
It also means she'd be crazy again, but that was a technicality for later. It felt like an eternity before he answered, and my anxiety grew. Lissa couldn't compel forever, and I told Mia I would be fast. This plan would fall apart if I didn't get out soon. yet watching him deliberate, I could see his mask falter. After all this time, he still loved his Sonya.
If what you're saying is true, and I don't believe it, then I'm coming with you. Whoa, no, not in the plan.
You can't, I said swiftly. I've already got people in place.
Another small lie.
Adding more might ruin things. I'm not doing it alone, I said, cutting off what I figured would be his next argument. If you really want to help me, really want to take a chance on bringing her back, you need to let me go.
There's no way it can be true,
he repeated, but there was doubt in his voice, and I played on it. Can you take that chance? More silence. I was starting to sweat now. Mikhail closed his eyes for a moment and took a deep breath. Then he stepped aside and gestured to the door.
Go.
I nearly sagged in relief and immediately grabbed the door handle. Thank you. Thank you so much.
I could get in a lot of trouble for this, he said wearily. And I still don't believe it's possible.
But you hope it is. I didn't need a response from him to know I was right. I opened the door, but before going through, I paused and glanced at him. This time, he no longer hid the grief and pain in his face. If you mean it, if you want to help, there might be a way you can. Another piece of the puzzle had unraveled itself for me. Another way we might pull this off. I explained what I needed from him and was surprised at how quickly he agreed. He really was like me, I realized. We both knew the idea of bringing back Strigoi was impossible, and yet we so wanted to believe it could be done. I slipped back upstairs alone after that. Don wasn't at his desk, and I wondered what Mia had done with him. I didn't wait to find out, and instead headed outside, off to a small courtyard that we'd established as our rendezvous point. Mia and Lyssa were both waiting there, pacing. No longer distracted with anxiety, I opened myself to the bond and felt Lyssa's agitation.
Thank God, she said when she saw me. We thought you'd been caught.
Well, it's a long story. One I didn't bother with. I got what I needed, and I actually got a whole lot more. I think we can do this. Mia gave me a look that was both wry and wistful. I sure do wish I knew what you guys were doing.
I shook my head as the three of us walked away.
No, I replied. I'm not sure that you do.
Chapter 5
Lyssa and I stayed up late when we returned to her room, poring over the documents. She was a jumble of feelings when I told her about my encounter with Mikhail, which I hadn't mentioned to Mia. Lyssa's initial reaction was surprise, but there were other things, too. Fear over the trouble I could have gotten into. A bit of warm romanticism over what both Mikhail and I were willing to do for those we loved. Wonder if she would do the same if Christian were in that situation. She decided instantly that she would. Her love for him was still that strong. Then she told herself that she actually didn't care about him anymore, which I would have found annoying if I wasn't so distracted.
What's wrong?
She asked. I'd sighed aloud in dismay without realizing and while I read her thoughts. Not wanting her to know I'd been perusing her mind, I pointed at the papers spread out on her bed. Just trying to make sense of this. Not entirely that far off from the truth. The prison's layout was complex. The cells occupied two floors and were tiny, only one prisoner per cell. The papers didn't explain why, but the reason was obvious. It went along with what Abe had said about keeping criminals from turning Strigoi. If I'd been locked away in prison for years, I can understand the temptation of cracking and killing my roommate to become Strigoi and escape. The cells were also kept housed in the very center of the building, surrounded by guards, offices, exercise rooms, a kitchen, and a feeder's room. The documents explained guard rotations, as well as prisoner feeding schedules. They were apparently escorted to the feeders one at a time, heavily guarded, and only allowed very short spurts of blood. Again, everything kept the prisoners weak, and prevented them from turning Strigoi. It was all good information, but I had no reason to believe any of it was up to date, since the file was 5 years old. It was also likely the prison had all sorts of new surveillance equipment in place.
Probably the only things we could count on being the same were the prison's location and the building's layout.
How good are you feeling about your charm-making skills? I asked Lissa. Although she hadn't been able to put as much spirit healing into my ring as a woman I knew named Oksana could, I had noticed my darkness-induced temper soothed a little. Lissa'd made a ring for Adrian, too, though I couldn't say for sure if it was what was helping him control his vices lately. Vices he usually indulged in to control spirit. She shrugged and rolled over onto her back. Exhaustion filled her, but she was trying to stay awake for my sake.
Getting better. Wish I could meet Oksana. Maybe someday, I said vaguely. I didn't think Oksana would ever leave Siberia. She'd run off with her guardian and wanted to keep a low profile. Besides, I didn't want Lissa over there anytime soon after my ordeals.
Have you been able to put in anything besides healing?
A moment later, I answered my own question.
Oh, right, the spoon.
Lissa grimaced, but it turned into a yawn.
I don't think it works so well.
Hmm?
I glanced back at the blueprints.
I'm thinking if you could make a few more compulsion charms, it would go a long way to help with this. We need to make people see what we want them to see.
Surely if Victor, whose powers of compulsion were nowhere near hers, had managed a lust charm, she could do what I needed. She just needed more practice. She understood the basic principles, but had trouble making her desired effects last. The only problem was that in asking her to do this, I was making her use more spirit. Even if the side effects didn't show up right away, they would likely come back to haunt her in the future. She glanced at me curiously, but when I saw her yawn again, I told her not to worry about it. I'd explain tomorrow. She offered no argument, and after a quick hug, we each retired to our own beds. We weren't going to get much sleep, but we had to get what we could. Tomorrow was a big day. I'd worn a variation of the Guardian's formal black and white outfit when I went to Victor's trial. In normal bodyguard situations, we wore ordinary clothes. But for fancy events, they wanted us looking crisp and professional. The morning after our daring break-in, I got my first true taste of Guardian fashion. I'd worn hand-me-down clothes at Victor's trial, but now had an official Guardian outfit, tailored exactly to my measurements. Straight-legged black slacks, a white button-up blouse, and a black dress jacket that fit me perfectly. It certainly wasn't meant to be sexy, but the way it hugged my stomach and hips did good things for my body. I felt satisfied with my reflection in the mirror, and after several minutes of thought, I pulled my hair into a neatly braided bun that showed off my Molniya marks. The skin was still irritated, but at least the bandage was gone. I looked very professional. I was actually kind of reminded of Sydney. She was an alchemist, a human who worked with Maroi and Dompierce to hide the existence of vampires from the world. With her proper sense of fashion, she always looked ready for a business meeting. I kept wanting to send her a briefcase for Christmas. If ever there was a time for me to show off, today was the day. After the trials and graduation, this was the next biggest step in becoming a guardian. It was a luncheon that all new grads attended. Maroi, eligible for new guardians, would also attend, hoping to scope out the candidates. Our scores from school and the trials would have been made public knowledge by now, and this was a chance for Maroi to meet us and put in bids for who they wanted to guard them. Naturally, most guests would be royal. But a few other important Maroi would also qualify. I really had no interest in showing off and hooking a posh family. Lissa was the only one I wanted to guard. Still, I had to make a good impression. I needed to make it clear that I was the one who should be with her. She and I walked over to the royal ballroom together. It was the only place large enough to hold us all, since more than just St. Vladimir's grads were in attendance. All the American schools had sent their new recruits. And for a moment, I found the sea of black and white dizzying. Bits of color, royals dressed up in their finest clothing, livened the palette up a little. Around us, soft watercolor murals made the walls seem to glow. Lissa hadn't worn a ball gown or anything, but she looked very elegant in a form-fitting teal dress made of raw silk. The royals mingled with the social ease they'd been raised with, but my classmates moved about uneasily. No one seemed to mind. It wasn't our job to seek out others. We would be approached. The grads all wore name tags, engraved metal ones. There were no "Hello, my name is" stickers here. The tags made us identifiable so that the royals could come and do their interrogations. I didn't expect anyone except my friends to talk to me, so Lissa and I headed straight for the buffet and then occupied a quiet corner to munch on our canapes and caviar. Well, Lissa ate caviar. It reminded me too much of Russia. Adrian, of course, sought us out first. I gave him a crooked grin. "What are you doing here? I know you aren't eligible for a guardian." With no concrete plans for his future, it was assumed Adrian would simply live at court. As such, he'd need no outside protection, though he'd certainly qualify if he chose to strike out into the world.
"True, but I could hardly miss a party," he said.
He held a glass of champagne in his hand, and I wondered if the effects of the ring Lissa had given him were wearing off. Of course, the occasional drink really wasn't the end of the world, and the dating proposals language had been loose in that area. It was mostly the smoking I wanted him to stay away from.
"Have you been approached by a dozen hopeful people?"
I shook my head.
"Who wants reckless Rose Hathaway? The one who drops out without warning to do her own thing?"
"Plenty," he said. "I sure do. You kicked ass in the battle, and remember, everyone thinks you went off on some Strigoi killing spree. Some might think it's worth your crazy personality."
"He's right," a voice suddenly said. I looked up and saw Tasha Ozera standing near us, a small smile on her scarred face. In spite of the disfigurement, I thought she looked beautiful today, more royal than I'd ever seen her. Her long black hair gleamed, and she wore a navy skirt and lacy tank top. She even had on high heels and jewelry, something I was certain I'd never seen her wearing. I was happy to see her. I hadn't known she'd come to court. An odd thought occurred to me. Have they finally let you have a guardian? The royals had a lot of quiet, polite ways of shunning those who were in disgrace. In the Ozera's case, their guardian allotment had been cut in half as kind of a punishment for what Christian's parents had done. It was totally unfair. The Ozeras deserved the same rights as any other royal family. She nodded.
"I think they're hoping it'll shut me up about Maroi fighting with Dompierre's. Kind of a bribe."
"One you won't fall for, I'm sure."
"Nope. If anything, it'll just give me someone to practice with."
Her smile faded, and she cast uncertain looks among us. "I hope you won't be offended, but I put in a request for you, Rose."
Lissa and I exchanged startled glances.
"Oh." I didn't know what else to say. "I hope they'll give you to Lissa," Tasha added hastily, clearly uncomfortable. "But the Queen seems pretty dead set on her own choices, if that's the case."
"It's okay," I said. "If I can't be with Lissa, then I really would rather be with you."
It was the truth. I wanted Lissa more than anyone else in the world, but if they kept us apart, then I'd absolutely prefer Tasha to some snobby royal. Of course, I was pretty sure my odds of getting assigned to her were as bad as those of getting assigned to Lissa. Those who were angry at me for running off would go out of their way to put me in the most unpleasant situation possible. And even if she was being granted a guardian, I had a feeling Tasha's preferences wouldn't be high priority either. My future was still a big question mark.
"Hey," exclaimed Adrian, offended that I hadn't named him as my second choice.
I shook my head at him.
"You know they'd assign me to a woman anyway. Besides, you've got to do something with your life to earn a guardian."
I meant it jokingly, but a small frown made me think I might have actually hurt his feelings. Tasha, meanwhile, looked relieved.
"I'm glad you don't mind. In the meantime, I'll do what I can to help you two."
She rolled her eyes. "Not that my opinion counts for much." Sharing my misgivings about getting assigned to Tasha seemed pointless. Instead, I started to thank her for the offer, but we were then joined by yet another visitor, Daniela Ivajkov.
"Adrian," she chastised gently, a small smile on her face, "you can't keep Rose and Vasilisa all to yourself."
She turned to Lissa and me.
"The Queen would like to see you both."
"Lovely."
We both stood up, but Adrian remained sitting, having no desire to visit his aunt. Tasha apparently didn't either. Seeing her,
Daniela gave a curt, polite nod. Lady Ozera? She then walked away, assuming we'd follow. I found it ironic that Daniela seemed willing to accept me, but still had that typical aloof Ozera prejudice. I guess her niceness only went so far. Tasha, however, had long since grown immune to that sort of treatment. Have fun, she said. She looked over at Adrian. More champagne?
Lady Ozera, he said grandly. You and I are two minds with a single thought.
I hesitated before following Lyssa to Tatiana. I'd taken in Tasha's grand appearance, but only now really paid attention to something. Is all your jewelry silver? I asked. She absentmindedly touched the opal necklace around her neck. Her fingers were adorned with three rings. Yes, she said, confused. Why?
This is going to sound really weird.
Well, maybe not compared to my normal weirdness. But could we, borrow all of those? Lyssa shot me a look and immediately guessed my motives. We needed more charms and were short on silver. Tasha arched an eyebrow, but like so many of my friends, she had a remarkable ability to roll with weird ideas. Sure, she said. But can I give them to you later? I don't really want to strip my jewelry in the middle of this party. No problem. I'll have them sent to your room. With that settled, Lyssa and I walked over to where Tatiana was surrounded by admirers and those wanting to suck up. Daniela had to be mistaken in saying Tatiana wanted to see both of us. The memory of her yelling at me over Adrian still burned in my head. And dinner at the Ivashkovs hadn't fooled me into thinking the queen and I were suddenly best friends. Yet, astonishingly, when she caught sight of Lyssa and me, she was all smiles.
Vasilisa and Rosemarie!
She beckoned us closer, and the group parted. I approached with Lyssa, my steps tentative. Was I going to get yelled at in front of all these people? Apparently not. There were always new royals to meet, and Tatiana first introduced Lyssa to all of them. Everyone was curious about the Dragomir princess. I was introduced as well, though the queen didn't go out of her way to sing my praises as she did Lyssa's. Still, being acknowledged at all was incredible.
Vasilisa, said Tatiana, once the formalities were finished. I was thinking you should visit Lehigh soon. Arrangements are being made for you to go in, oh, maybe a week and a half. We thought it would be a nice treat for your birthday. Serena and Grant will accompany you, naturally, and I'll send a few others.
Serena and Grant were the guardians who had replaced Dimitri and me as Lyssa's future protection. Of course they'd be going with her. Then, Tatiana said the most startling thing of all.
And you can go too if you'd like, Rose. Vasilisa could hardly celebrate without you.
Lyssa lit up. Lehigh University. The lore that had made her accept a life at court. Lyssa yearned for as much knowledge as she could get, and the queen had given her a chance at it. The prospect of a visit totally filled her with eagerness and excitement, especially if she could celebrate her 18th birthday there with me. It was enough to distract her from Victor and Christian, which was saying something.
Thank you, Your Majesty, that'd be great.
There was a strong possibility, I knew, that we might not be around for this scheduled visit, not if my plan for Victor worked. But I didn't want to ruin Lyssa's happiness, and I could hardly mention it in this royal crowd. I was also kind of stunned that I'd been invited at all. After issuing the invite, the queen said nothing else to me and continued speaking with the others around her. Yet, she'd been pleasant, for her, at least, while addressing me, just as she had at the Ivashkov home. Not best friend nice, but certainly not raving bitch insane either. Maybe Daniela had been right. More pleasantries followed as everyone chatted and tried to impress the queen, and it soon became clear that I was no longer needed. Glancing around the room, I found someone I needed to talk to and meekly separated myself from the group, knowing Lyssa could fend for herself. Eddie, I called, reaching the other side of the ballroom. Alone at last. Eddie Castile, a longtime friend of mine, grinned when he saw me. He too was a Dompier, tall with a long, narrow face that still had a cute boyish look to it. He had tamed his dark sandy blonde hair for a change. Lyssa had once hoped Eddie and I would date, but he and I were strictly just friends. His best friend had been Mason, a sweet guy who'd been crazy about me and who had been murdered by Strigoi. After his death, Eddie and I had adopted protective attitudes toward each other. He'd later been kidnapped during the attack at St. Vladimir's, and his experiences had made him a serious and determined guardian, sometimes a little too serious. I wanted him to have more fun, and was delighted to see the happy glint in his hazel eyes now.
"I think every royal in the room's been trying to bribe you," I teased.
It wasn't entirely a joke. I'd been keeping an eye on him throughout the party, and there'd always been someone with him. His record was stellar. Surviving the awful events in his life might have scarred him, but they reflected well on his skills. He had great grades and ratings from the trial. Most importantly, he didn't have my reckless reputation. He was a good catch.
"Kind of seems that way," he laughed. "I didn't really expect it."
"You're so modest. You're the hottest thing in this room."
"Not compared to you."
"Yeah, as shown by the people lining up to talk to me. Tasha Ozera's the only one who wants me as far as I know. And Lyssa, of course."
Lines of thought creased Eddie's face.
"Could be worse."
"It will be worse. No way will I get either of them."
We fell silent, and a sudden anxiety filled me. I'd come to ask a favor of Eddie, and it no longer seemed like a good idea. Eddie was on the verge of a shining career. He was a loyal friend, and I'd been certain he'd help with what I needed, but I suddenly didn't think I could ask. Like Mia, however, Eddie was observant.
"What's wrong, Rose?"
His voice was concerned, that protective nature kicking in. I shook my head. I couldn't do it.
"Nothing."
"Rose?"
he said warningly. I looked away, unable to meet his eyes.
"It's not important, really."
I'd find another way, someone else. To my surprise, he reached out to touch my chin and tip my head back. His gaze caught mine, allowing no escape.
"What do you need?"
I stared at him for a long time. I was so selfish, risking the lives and reputations of friends I cared about. If Christian and Lyssa weren't on the outs, I'd be asking him too. But Eddie was all that was left to me. "I need something. Something that's pretty extreme." His face was still serious, but his lips tugged into a wry smile.
"Everything you do is extreme, Rose."
"Not like this. This is, well, it's something that could ruin everything for you. Get you in big trouble. I can't do that to you."
That half-smile vanished.
"It doesn't matter,"
he said fiercely.
"If you need me, I'll do it, no matter what it is."
"You don't know what it is."
"I trust you."
"It's kind of illegal, treasonous even."
That took him aback for a moment, but he stayed resolute.
"Whatever you need. I don't care. I've got your back."
I'd saved Eddie's life twice, and I knew he meant what he said. He felt indebted to me. He would go wherever I asked, not out of romantic love, but out of friendship and loyalty.
"It's illegal," I repeated. "You'd have to sneak out of court. Tonight. And I don't know when we'd be back."
It was entirely possible that we wouldn't come back. If we had a run-in with prison guards, well, they might take lethal measures to do their duty. It was what all of us had trained for. But I couldn't pull this breakout off with Lyssa's compulsion alone. I needed another fighter at my back.
"Just tell me when."
And that was all there was to it. I didn't tell him the full extent of our plan, but I gave him that night's rendezvous location and told him what we would need to bring. He never questioned me. He said he'd be there. New royals came to talk to him just then, and I left him, knowing he'd show up later. It was hard, but I pushed aside my guilt over possibly endangering his future. Eddie arrived, just as he'd promised, when my plan unfolded later that night. Lyssa did too. Again, night meant broad daylight. I felt that same anxiety I did when we'd sneaked around with Mia. Light exposed everything, but then most people were asleep. Lyssa, Eddie, and I still moved through the court's grounds as covertly as we could, meeting Mikhail in a section of the compound that held all sorts of garaged vehicles. The garages were big metal, industrial-looking buildings set on the fringes of court, and no one else was out. We slipped into the garage he'd indicated last night, and I was relieved to find no one else there. He surveyed the three of us, looking surprised at my strike team, but he offered no questions and made no further attempts to join us. More guilt surged up within me. Here was someone else who was risking his future for me.
"Gonna be a tight fit," he mused.
I forced a smile.
"We're all friends here." Mikhail didn't laugh at my joke, but instead popped the trunk of a black Dodge Charger. He wasn't kidding about the tight fit.
It was a newer one, which was kind of a shame. An older model would have been bigger. The Guardians only kept top-of-the-line stuff around.
"Once we're far enough away, I'll pull over and let you out," he said.
"We'll be fine," I assured him. "Let's do this." Lissa, Eddie, and I crawled into the trunk.
"Oh, God," muttered Lissa. "I hope no one's claustrophobic."
It was like a bad game of Twister. The trunk was large enough for some luggage, but not intended for three people. We were squeezed together, and personal space was non-existent. We were all up close and personal. Satisfied we were all snug, Mikhail closed the trunk and darkness engulfed us. The engine started a minute later, and I felt the car move.
"How long until you think we stop?" asked Lissa.
"Or die from carbon monoxide poisoning." "We haven't even left the court yet," I noted. She sighed. The car drove off, and not too long afterward, we came to a stop. Mikhail must have reached the gates and been chatting with the guards. He told me earlier that he'd come up with some excuse or other to run an errand, and we had no reason to believe the guards would question him or search the car. The court wasn't worried about people sneaking out, like our school had been. The biggest concern here was people getting inside. A minute passed, and I uneasily wondered if there was a problem. Then the car moved again, and all three of us exhaled in relief. We picked up speed, and after what I suspected was a mile or so, the car veered sideways and came to a stop. The trunk popped open, and we spilled out of it. I'd never been so grateful for fresh air. I got in the passenger seat beside Mikhail, and Lissa and Eddie took the back. Once we were settled, Mikhail continued driving without another word. I allowed myself a few more moments of guilt over the people I'd involved, but then let it go. It was too late to worry now. I also let go of my guilt about Adrian. He would have been a good ally, but I could hardly ask for his help in this. And with that, I settled back and turned my thoughts to the job before us. It would take us about an hour to get to the airport, and from there, the three of us were off to Alaska.
Chapter 6.
You know what we need? I was sitting between Eddie and Lissa on our flight from Seattle to Fairbanks. As the shortest, marginally, and the mastermind, I'd gotten stuck with the middle seat.
"A new plan?" asked Lissa.
"A miracle?"
asked Eddie. I paused and glared at them both before responding. Since when had they become the comedians here?
"No. Stuff. We need cool gadgets if we're going to pull this off."
I tapped the prison blueprint that had been on my lap for almost every part of our trip so far. Mikhail had dropped us off at a small airport an hour away from the court. We'd caught a commuter flight from there to Philadelphia, and from there to Seattle, and now Fairbanks. It reminded me a little of the crazy flights I'd had to take from Siberia back to the U.S. That journey had also gone via Seattle. I was starting to believe that city was a gateway to obscure places.
"I thought the only tools we needed were our wits,"
mused Eddie. He might be serious about his guardian work most of the time, but he could also turn on his dry humor when relaxed. Not that he was totally at ease with our mission here, now that he knew more of, but not all, the details. I knew he'd snap back into readiness once we landed. He'd been understandably shocked when I'd revealed we were freeing Viktor Dashkov. I hadn't told Eddie anything about Dmitri or Spirit, only that getting Viktor out played a larger role in the greater good. Eddie's trust in me was so implicit that he'd taken me at my word and pursued the issue no further. I wondered how he'd react when he learned the truth. "At the very least, we're going to need a GPS," I said. "There's only latitude and longitude on this thing. No real directions."
"Shouldn't be hard,"
said Lissa, turning a bracelet over and over in her hands. She'd opened her tray and spread out Tasha's jewelry across it. I'm sure even Alaska has modern technology. She'd also turned on a droll attitude, even with anxiety radiating through the bond. Eddie's good mood faded a little.
I hope you aren't thinking of guns or anything like that.
No, absolutely not. If this works how we want, no one will even know we're there. A physical confrontation was likely, but I hoped to minimize serious injury. Lissa sighed and handed me the bracelet. She was worried because a lot of my plan depended on her charms, literally and figuratively. I don't know if this'll work, but maybe it'll give you more resistance. I took the bracelet and slipped it on my wrist. I felt nothing, but I only rarely did with charmed objects. I'd left Adrian a note saying that Lissa and I had wanted to escape for a girl's getaway before my assignment and her college visit. I knew he'd be hurt. The girl angle would carry a lot of weight, but he'd feel injured at not being invited along on a daring vacation, if he even believed we were on one. He probably knew me well enough by now to guess most of my actions had ulterior motives. My hope was that he'd spread the story to court officials when our disappearance was noticed. We'd still get in trouble, but a wild weekend was better than a prison break. And honestly, how could things get worse for me? The one flaw here was that Adrian could visit my dreams and grill me on what was really going on. It was one of the most interesting and occasionally annoying spirit abilities. Lissa hadn't learned to walk dreams, but she had a crude understanding of the principle. Between that and compulsion, she tried to charm the bracelet in a way that would block Adrian when I slept later. The plane began its descent into Fairbanks, and I gazed out the window at tall pines and stretches of green land. In Lissa's thoughts, I read how she'd been half expecting glaciers and snowbanks, despite knowing it was full summer here. After Siberia, I'd learned to keep an open mind about regional stereotypes. My biggest concern was the sun. It had been full daylight when we'd left the court, and as our travels took us west, the time zone change meant that the sun stayed with us. Now, though it was almost 9 in the evening, we had a full sunny blue sky, thanks to our northern latitude. It was like a giant safety blanket. I hadn't mentioned this to Lissa or Eddie, but it seemed likely Dimitri would have spies everywhere. I was untouchable at St. Vladimir's and the court, but his letters had clearly stated he'd be waiting for me to leave those boundaries. I didn't know the extent of his logistics, but humans watching the court in daylight wouldn't have surprised me. And even though I'd left hidden in a trunk, there was a strong possibility that Dimitri was already in pursuit. But the same light that guarded the prisoners would keep us safe, too. We'd barely have a few hours of night to guard against, and if we pulled this off quickly, we'd be out of Alaska in hardly any time at all. Of course, that might not be such a good thing. We'd lose the sun. Our first complication came after we landed and tried to rent a car. Eddie and I were 18, but none of the car companies would rent to anyone so young. After the third refusal, my anger began to grow. Who would have thought we'd be delayed by something so idiotic? Finally, at a fourth counter, the woman hesitantly told us that there was a guy about a mile from the airport who would likely rent us a car if we had a credit card and a big enough deposit. We made the walk in pleasant weather, but I could tell the sun was starting to bother Lissa by the time we reached our destination. Bud, of Bud's Rental Cars, didn't seem quite as sleazy as expected, and did indeed rent us a car when we produced enough money. From there, we got a room at a modest motel and went over our plans again. All our information indicated that the prison ran on a vampire schedule, which meant this was their active time of the day. Our plan was to stay in the hotel until the following day, when the Moroi night came, and catch some sleep beforehand. It gave Lissa more time to work on her charms. Our room was easily defendable. My sleep was Adrian-free, for which I was grateful, meaning he'd either accepted the girl trip or couldn't break through Lissa's bracelet. In the morning, we rustled up some donuts for breakfast and ate a little bleary-eyed. Running against our vampire schedule was throwing us all off a little. The sugar helped kickstart us, though, and Eddie and I left Lissa around 10 to go do some scouting. We bought my coveted GPS and a few other things at a sporting goods store along the way and used it to navigate remote country roads that seemed to lead nowhere. When the GPS claimed we were a mile from the prison, we pulled off to the side of a small dirt road and set off on foot across a field of tall grass that stretched endlessly before us.
"I thought Alaska was tundra," said Eddie,
crunching through the tall stalks. The sky was blue and clear again, with only a few clouds that did nothing to keep the sun away. I'd started out in a light jacket, but now had it tied around my waist as I sweated. Occasionally, a welcome gust of wind would roll through, flattening the grass and whipping my hair around. "I guess not all parts, or maybe we have to go further north." "Oh, hey, this looks promising." We came to a stop before a high, barbed wire fence with an enormous private property, no unauthorized personnel allowed, sign on it. The lettering was red, apparently to emphasize how serious they were. Personally, I would have added a skull and crossbones to really drive the message home. Eddie and I studied the fence for a few moments, then gave each other resigned glances. "Lissa will heal up anything we get," I said hopefully. Climbing barbed wire isn't impossible, but it's not fun. Tossing my jacket on the wires I had to grip went a long way to protect me, but I still ended up with some scratches and snagged clothing. Once I was at the top, I jumped down, preferring the jolting landing to another climb down. Eddie did the same, grimacing at the hard impact. We walked a little further, and then the dark line of a building came into sight. We both came to a halt as one and knelt down, seeking what coverage we could in the grass. The prison file had indicated that they had cameras on the outside, which meant we risked detection if we got too close. I'd bought high-power binoculars along with the GPS and took them out now, studying the building's exterior. The binoculars were good, really good, as well they should have been for the price. The level of detail was amazing. Like so many Maroy creations, the building was a mixture of the old and the new. The walls were made of sinister gray stone blocks and almost entirely obscured the actual prison, whose roof just barely peeped above. A couple of figures paced along the top of the walls, living eyes to go with the cameras. The place looked like a fortress, impenetrable and inescapable. It deserved to be on a rocky cliff with a sinister black sky behind it. The field and sun seemed out of place. I handed the binoculars to Eddie. He made his own assessment and then gestured to the left.
"There."
Squinting, I just barely made out a truck or SUV driving up toward the prison. It went around the back and vanished from sight. "Our only way in," I murmured, recalling the blueprint. We knew we had no shot of scaling the walls or even getting close enough on foot without being spotted. We needed to literally walk through the front door, and that's where the plan got a little sketchy. Eddie lowered the binoculars and glanced over at me, brow furrowed.
"I meant what I said before, you know. I trust you. Whatever reason you're doing this, I know it's a good one. But before things start moving, are you sure this is what you want?"
I gave a harsh laugh.
"Want? No,
but it's what we need to do." He nodded.
"Good enough."
We watched the prison a while longer, moving around to get different angles while still keeping a wide perimeter. The scenario was about what we'd expected, but having a 3D visual was still helpful. After about a half hour, we returned to the hotel. Lissa sat cross-legged on one of the beds, still working on the charms. The feelings coming through her were warm and content. Spirit always made her feel good, even if it had side effects later, and she thought she was making progress. "Adrian called my cell phone twice," she told me when we entered.
"But you didn't answer?"
"Nope, poor guy." I shrugged. "It's better this way." We gave her a rundown of what we'd seen, and her happy mood began to plummet. Our visit made what we were going to do later today more and more real, and working with so much spirit had already put her on edge. A few moments later, I sensed her swallowing her fear. She became resolved. She'd told me she would do this, and she intended to stand by her word, even though she dreaded each second that brought her closer to Victor Dashkov. Lunch followed, and then a few hours later, it was time to put the plan into motion. It was early evening for humans, which meant the vampiric night would be drawing to an end soon. It was now or never. Lissa nervously distributed the charms she'd made for us, worried they wouldn't work. Eddie dressed up in his newly bestowed black and white guardian formal wear, while Lissa and I stayed in our street clothes, with a couple alterations. Lissa's hair was a mousy brown, the result of some wash-in temporary hair color. My hair was tightly bound up underneath a curly red wig that reminded me uncomfortably of my mother. We sat in the back seat of the car while Eddie drove us chauffeur-style back along the remote road we'd followed earlier. Unlike before, we didn't pull over. We stayed on the road, driving right up to the prison. Or, well, to its gatehouse. No one spoke as we drove, but the tension and anxiety within us all grew and grew. Before we could even get near the outer wall, there was a checkpoint manned by a guardian. Eddie brought the car to a stop, and I tried to look calm. He lowered the window, and the guardian on duty walked over and knelt so that they were at eye level.
"What's your business here?"
Eddie handed over a piece of paper, his attitude confident and unconcerned, as though this were perfectly normal.
"Dropping off new feeders."
The file had contained all sorts of forms and papers for prison business, including status reports and order forms for supplies, like feeders. We'd made a copy of one of the feeder requisition forms and filled it out.
"I wasn't notified of a delivery,"
the guardian said, not suspicious so much as puzzled. He peered at the paperwork.
"This is an old form."
Eddie shrugged.
"It's what they gave me. I'm kind of new at this."
The man grinned.
"Yeah, you barely look old enough to be out of school."
He glanced over toward Lissa and me, and despite of my practice control, I tensed. The guardian frowned as he studied us. Lissa had given me a necklace, and she'd taken a ring, both charmed with a slight compulsion spell to make others think we were human. It would have been much easier to make her victim wear a charm and force them to think they were seeing humans, but that was impossible. The magic was harder this way. He squinted, almost like he was looking at us through a haze. If the charms had worked perfectly, he wouldn't have given us a second glance. The charms were a little flawed. They were changing our appearances, but not quite as clearly as we'd hoped. That was why we'd gone to the trouble of altering our hair. If the human illusion failed, we'd still have some identity protection. Lissa readied herself to work direct compulsion, though we'd hoped it wouldn't come to that with every person we met. A few moments later, the guardian turned from us, apparently deciding we were human after all. I exhaled and unclenched my fists. I hadn't even realized I'd been holding them.
"Hang on a minute, and I'll call this in,"
he told Eddie. The guardian stepped away and picked up a phone inside his booth. Eddie glanced back at us.
"So far, so good?"
"Aside from the old form," I grumbled.
"No way to know if my charm's working?"
asked Eddie. Lissa had given him one of Tasha's rings, charmed to make him appear tan-skinned and black-haired. Since she wasn't altering his race, the magic only needed to blur his features. Like our human charms, I suspected it wasn't projecting the exact image she'd hoped for, but it should have altered his appearance enough that no one would identify Eddie later. With our resistance to compulsion, and knowing there was a charm in place, which negated its effects on us, Lissa and I couldn't say for certain what he looked like to others.
"I'm sure it's fine," said Lissa reassuringly.
The guardian returned.
"They say go on in, and they'll sort it out there." "Thanks,"
said Eddie, taking the form back. The guard's attitude implied that he assumed this was a clerical error. He was still diligent, but the idea of someone sneaking feeders into a prison was hardly the kind of thing one would expect, or view as a security risk. Poor guy. Two guardians greeted us when we arrived at the door in the prison's wall. The three of us got out and were led into the grounds between the wall and the prison itself. Whereas St. Vladimir's and the court's grounds had been lush and filled with plants and trees, the land here was stark and lonely. Not even grass, just hard-packed earth. Was this what served as the prisoners' exercise area? Were they even allowed outside at all? I was surprised there wasn't a moat of some sort out here. The inside of the building was as grim as its exterior. The holding cells at court were sterile and cold, all metal and blank walls. I'd expected something similar. But whoever had designed Tarasov had forgone the modern look and instead emulated the kind of prison one might have found back in Romania in medieval days. The harsh stone walls continued down the hall, gray and foreboding, and the air was chill and damp. It had to make for unpleasant working conditions for the guardians assigned here. Presumably, they wanted to ensure the intimidating facade extended everywhere, even for prisoners first entering the gates. According to our blueprint, there was a little section of dorms where employees lived. Hopefully, those were nicer. Dark Ages decor or not, we passed the occasional camera as we walked down the hallway. This place's security was in no way primitive. Occasionally, we heard the heavy slamming of a door, but overall, there was a perfect, eerie silence that was almost creepier than shouts and screams. We were taken to the warden's office, a room that still had the same gloomy architecture, yet was filled with the usual administrative accessories. Desk, computer, etc. It looked efficient, nothing more. Our escorts explained that we were going to see the assistant warden, since the senior one was still in bed. It figured, the subordinate would have gotten stuck with the night shift. I hoped that meant he was tired and unobservant. Probably not. That rarely happened to guardians, no matter their assignments.
"Theo Marks," said the assistant warden, shaking Eddie's hand.
He was a Dampier not much older than us, and I wondered if he'd only been freshly assigned here.
"Larry Brown," replied Eddie.
We'd come up with a boring name for him, one that wouldn't stand out, and had used it in the paperwork. Theo didn't speak to Lissa and me, but he did give us that same puzzled glance the first guy had as the charm's glamour attempted its illusion. Another delay followed, but once more, we slipped through. Theo returned his attention to Eddie and took the requisition form.
"This is different from the usual one," he said. "I have no clue," said Eddie apologetically. "This is my first time."
Theo sighed and glanced at the clock.
"The warden will be on duty in another couple hours. I think we're just going to have to wait until he's here to figure out what's going on. Summerfield's usually got their act together."
There were a few Moroi facilities in the country that gathered feeders, those on the fringes of human society who were content to spend their lives high on vampire endorphins, and then distributed them. Summerfield was the name of one such facility, located in Kansas City.
"I'm not the only new person they just received," Eddie said. "Maybe someone got confused."
"Typical,"
snorted Theo.
"Well, you might as well have a seat and wait. I can get coffee if you want."
"When are we getting a feeding?" I suddenly asked, using the whiniest, dreamiest voice I could. "It's been so long." Lissa followed my lead.
"They said we could when we got here."
Eddie rolled his eyes at what was typical feeder behavior.
"They've been like this the whole time."
"I can imagine," said Theo. "Feeders."
The door to his office was partially ajar, and he called out of it.
"Hey, Wes, can you come here?"
One of the escort guardians stuck his head inside.
"Yeah?"
Theo gave us a dismissive wave.
"Take these two down to the feeding area so they don't drive us crazy. If someone's up, they can use them."
Wes nodded and beckoned us out. Eddie and I made the briefest of eye contact. His face betrayed nothing, but I knew he was nervous. Getting Victor out was our job now, and Eddie didn't like sending us to the dragon's lair. Wes led us through more doors and security checkpoints as we went deeper into the prison. I realized that for every layer of security I crossed to get in, I was going to have to cross it again to escape. According to the blueprint, the feeding area was situated on the opposite side of the prison. I'd assumed we'd take some route along the periphery, but instead, we cut right through the building's center, where the prisoners were kept. Studying had given me a sense of the layout, but Lissa didn't realize where we were headed until a sign alerted us. Warning. Now entering prisoner area. Criminal. I thought that was an odd wording. Wasn't everyone in here a criminal? Heavy double doors blocked this section off, and Wes used both an electronic code and a physical key to cross through. Lissa's pace didn't change, but I felt her anxiety increase as we entered a long corridor lined with bar-covered cells. I didn't feel any better about it myself, but Wes, while still alert, didn't display any sign of fear. He entered this area all the time, I realized. He knew its security. The prisoners might be dangerous, but passing by them was a routine activity for him. Still, peeking inside the cells nearly made my heart stop. The little compartments were as dark and gloomy as anything, containing only bare-bones furnishings. Most of the prisoners were asleep, thankfully. A few, however, watched as we walked by. None of them said anything, but the silence was almost scarier. Some of the Maroi held there looked like ordinary people you'd pass on the street, and I wondered what they could have possibly done to end up here. Their faces were sad, devoid of all hope. I did a double take and realized that some of the prisoners weren't Maroi. They were Dampiers. It made sense, but still caught me off guard. My own kind would have criminals that needed to be dealt with, too. But not all of the prisoners appeared benign. Others looked like they definitely belonged in Tarasov. There was malevolence about them, a sinister feel as their eyes locked onto us and didn't let go. They scrutinized our every detail, though for what reason I couldn't say. Were they seeking out anything that might offer escape? Could they see through our facades? Were they simply hungry? I didn't know, but felt grateful for the silent guardians posted throughout the hall. I was also grateful that I didn't see Victor, and assumed he lived in a different hall. We couldn't risk being recognized yet. We finally exited the prisoner's corridor through another set of double doors, and at last reached the feeding area. It too felt like a medieval dungeon, but images had to be kept up for the sake of the prisoners. Decor aside, the feeding room's layout was similar to what St. Vladimir's had, except it was smaller. A few cubicles offered moderate privacy, and a bored-looking Maroi guy was reading a book at a desk, but looked ready to fall asleep. There was only one feeder in the room, a scraggly-looking middle-aged human who sat in a chair with a dopey smile on his face, staring at nothing. The Maroi flinched when we entered, his eyes going wide. Clearly, we were the most exciting thing to happen to him all night. He didn't have that moment of disorientation when he glanced at us. He apparently had low compulsion resistance, which was good to know.
"What's this?"
"Two new ones just came in," said Wes.
"But we're not due," said the Maroi.
"And we never get ones this young. They always give us the old used-up ones."
"Don't ask me,"
said Wes, moving toward the door once he indicated seats for Lissa and me. It was clear he found escorting feeders beneath him.
"Marks wants them here until Sullivan gets up. My guess is it's going to turn out to be a mistake, but they were complaining about needing a fix."
"Wonderful," groaned the Maroi. "Well, our next meal's due in 15 minutes, so I can give Bradley over there a break. He's so gone, I doubt he'd notice if someone else gave blood instead of him." Wes nodded.
"We'll call down when we've got this straight."
The guardian left, and the Maroi picked up a clipboard with a sigh. I had the feeling everyone here was kind of tired of their jobs. I could understand why. This had to be a miserable place to work. Give me the wider world any time. "Who's due to feed in 15 minutes? I asked. The Maroi's head jerked up in astonishment. It wasn't the kind of question a feeder asked.
"What did you say?"
Lissa stood up and got him in her gaze.
"Answer her question."
The man's face went slack. He was easy to compel. "Rudolf Kaiser." No one either of us recognized. He could have been here for mass murder or embezzlement for all I knew.
"When's Victor Dashkov due?"
asked Lissa.
2 hours.
"Alter the schedule. Tell his guards there has been a readjustment and he has to come now instead of Rudolf."
The Maroi's blank eyes, now as dazed looking as Bradley the feeder's really, seemed to take a moment to process this. "Yes," he said.
"This is something that might happen normally. It won't raise suspicion."
"It won't raise suspicion," he repeated in a monotone.
"Do it," she ordered, voice hard. "Call them. Set it up, and do not take your eyes off of me."
The Maroi complied. While speaking on the phone, he identified himself as Northwood. When he disconnected, the arrangements had been made. We had nothing to do but wait now. My entire body was tightly wound with tension. Theo had said we had over an hour until the warden was on duty. No one would ask questions until then. Eddie simply had to kill time with Theo and not raise suspicions behind a paperwork error. "Calm down, Rose. You can do this." While we waited, Lissa compelled Bradley the feeder into a heavy sleep. I didn't want any witnesses,
not even drugged ones.
Likewise, I turned the room's camera ever so slightly so it no longer could see the bulk of the room. Naturally, we'd have to deal with the prison's entire surveillance system before we left, but for now, we needed no watching security personnel to catch sight of what was about to happen. I had just settled into one of the cubicles when the door opened. Lissa had stayed in her chair near Northwood's desk so that she could keep her compulsion on him. We'd instructed him that I would be the feeder. I was enclosed, but through Lissa's sight, I saw the group enter. Two guardians and Victor Dashkoff. The same distress she'd felt when seeing him at her trial shot up within her. Her heart rate increased. Her hands shook. The only thing that had finally calmed her back at the trial was the resolution of it all, knowing Victor would be locked away forever and unable to hurt her again. And now we were about to change all that. Forcibly, Lissa shoved her fear out of her mind so that she could keep her hold on Northwood. The guardians beside Victor were stern and ready for action, though they didn't really need to be. The sickness that had plagued him for years, the one Lissa had temporarily healed him of, was starting to rear its head again. Lack of exercise and fresh air appeared to have taken a toll, too, as had the limited blood prisoners were supposedly given. The guards had him clad in shackles as an extra precaution, and the heavy weight dragged him down, almost making him shuffle.
"Over there," said Northwood, pointing at me. "That one."
The guardians led Victor past Lissa, and he barely gave her a second glance. She was working double compulsion, keeping Northwood under her control and using a quick burst to make herself insignificant to Victor when he walked by. The guardian settled him into a chair beside me and then stepped back, still keeping him in sight. One of them struck up conversation with Northwood, noting our newness and youth. If I ever did this again, I'd have Lissa charm us into looking older. Sitting beside me, Victor leaned toward me and opened his mouth. Feedings were so second nature, the motions always the same, that he hardly had to think about what he did. It was like he didn't even see me. Except then, he did. He froze, his eyes going wide. Certain characteristics marked the Royal Moroi families, and light, jade-green eyes ran amongst both the Dashkovs and the Dragomirs. The weary, resigned look in his disappeared, and the cunning sharpness that so characterized him, the shrewd intellect I knew well, snapped into place. It reminded me eerily of some of the prisoners we'd passed earlier. But he was confused. Like the other people we'd encountered, my charm was muddling his thoughts. His senses told him I was a human, yet the illusion wasn't perfect. There was also the fact that Victor, as a strong non-spirit compulsion wielder, was relatively resistant to it. And just as Eddie, Lissa, and I had been immune to one another's charms because we knew our true identities, Victor experienced the same effect. His mind might insist that I was human, but his eyes told him I was Rose Hathaway, even with my wig. And once that knowledge was solidified, the human illusion disappeared for him. A slow, intrigued smile spread over his face, blatantly displaying his fangs. "Oh my, this might be the best meal I've ever had." His voice was barely audible, covered by the conversation of the others. "Put your teeth anywhere near me, and it'll be your last meal," I murmured, voice just as quiet. "But if you want any chance of getting out of here and seeing the world again, you'll do exactly what I say." He gave me a questioning look. I took a deep breath, dreading what I had to say next. "Attack me."
Chapter 7.
"Not with your teeth," I added hastily. "Throw yourself at me. Swing your shackles, whatever you can do." Victor Dashkoff was not a stupid man. Others might have hesitated or asked more questions. He did not. He might not know exactly what was going on, but he sensed that this was a shot at freedom, possibly the only one he'd ever get. He was someone who had spent a large part of his life masterminding complicated plots, so he was a pro at slipping right into them. Holding his hands up as much as he could manage, he lunged at me, making a good show of trying to choke me with the chain between his cuffs. As he did, I gave a blood-curdling shriek. In an instant, the guardians were there to stop his crazy prisoner who was senselessly attacking a poor girl. But as they reached to subdue him, I leapt up and attacked them, even if they'd expected me to be dangerous, and they hadn't. I had so much surprise on them that they had no time to react. I almost felt bad at how unfair it was to them. I punched the first hard enough that he lost his grip on Victor and flew backward, hitting the wall near Lyssa as she frantically compelled Northwood to stay calm and not call anyone in the midst of this chaos. The other guardian had slightly more time to react, but he was still slow in letting go of Victor and turning on me. I used the opening and got a punch in, forcing the two of us into a grappling match. He was big and formidable, and once he deemed me a threat, he didn't hold back. A blow to my shoulder sent shooting pain through my arm, and I responded with a swift knee in his stomach. Meanwhile, his counterpart was on his feet heading toward us. I had to end this fast, not only for my own sake, but also because they would undoubtedly call for backup if given a moment's chance. I grabbed the one closest to me and pushed him as hard as I could into a wall, head first. He staggered, dazed, and I did it again, just as his partner reached me. That first guardian slumped to the ground, unconscious. I hated doing that, but part of my training had been learning to differentiate between incapacitating and killing. He should only have a headache, I hoped. The other guardian was very much on the offensive, however, and he and I circled each other, getting in some shots and dodging others. "I can't knock him out," I called to Lyssa. "We need him. Compel him." Her response came through the bond. She could compel two people at the same time, but it took a lot of strength. We weren't out of this yet, and she couldn't risk burning herself out so soon. Frustration replaced fear within her.
"Northwood, go to sleep," she barked. "Right there, on your desk. You're exhausted and will sleep for hours."
Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Northwood slump, his head hitting the desk with a thump. Everyone who worked here would have a concussion by the time we were through. I threw myself at the guardian then, using my full weight to get him within Lyssa's line of sight. She pushed her way into our fight. He glanced at her in surprise, and that was all she needed.
"Stop!"
He didn't respond as quickly as Northwood, but he did hesitate. This guy was more resistant.
"Stop fighting!"
she repeated more forcefully, intensifying her will. Strong or not, he couldn't stand against that much spirit. His arms fell to his sides, and he stopped wrestling me. I stepped back to catch my breath, straightening my wig back into place.
"Holding this one's going to be hard," Lyssa told me.
"Hard as in 5 minutes or 5 hours?"
"Somewhere in the middle."
"Then let's move. Get Victor's key from him." She demanded the guardian give her the key for the shackles. He told us the other guardian had it. Sure enough, I frisked the unconscious body. He was breathing steadily, thank God, and retrieved the key. Now I turned my full attention on Victor. Once the fight had started, he'd stepped out of the way and simply observed quietly while all sorts of new possibilities undoubtedly formed in his twisted mind. I approached and put on my scary face as I held up the key. "I'm going to unlock your cuffs now," I told him in a voice both sweet and menacing. "You're going to do exactly what we tell you to do. You're not going to run, start a fight, or in any way interfere with our plans."
"Oh, are you using compulsion nowadays too, Rose?" he asked dryly.
"I don't need it." I unlocked the shackles. "I can render you unconscious as easily as that guy and drag you out. Makes no difference to me." The heavy cuffs and chains fell to the floor. That sly, smug look stayed on his face, but his hands gently touched each wrist. I noticed then that there were welts and bruises on them. The shackles weren't meant for comfort, but I refused to feel sorry for him. He glanced back up at us.
"How charming," he mused.
"Out of all the people who would attempt to rescue me, I never would have expected you to. And yet, in retrospect, you're probably the most capable."
"We don't need your running commentary, Hannibal," I snapped. "And don't use the word rescue. It makes it sound like you're some wrongfully imprisoned hero."
He arched an eyebrow, like he believed that might indeed be the case. Instead of disputing me, he nodded toward Bradley, who had actually slept through the fight. In his drugged state, Lyssa's compulsion had been more than enough to knock him out.
"Give him to me," said Victor.
"What?" I exclaimed, We don't have time for this.
And I have no strength for whatever you have in mind, hissed Victor.
That pleasant and all-knowing mask vanished, replaced by one vicious and desperate.
Imprisonment involves more than bars, Rose. They starve us of food and blood, trying to keep us weak. Walking here is the only exercise I get, and that's effort enough. Unless you really do plan on dragging me out of here, give me blood!
Lyssa interrupted any response I could make.
Be fast!
I stared at her in astonishment. I'd been about to deny Victor, but through the bond, I felt an odd mix of feelings from her. Compassion and understanding. Oh, she still hated him, absolutely. But she also knew what it was like to live on limited blood. Mercifully, Victor was fast. His mouth was at the human's neck practically before Lyssa finished speaking. Dazed or no, feeling teeth in his neck was enough to wake Bradley up. He woke with a start, his face soon moving into the delight feeders took from vampire endorphins. A short burst of blood was all Victor would need. But when Bradley's eyes started to go wide in surprise, I realized Victor was taking more than a quick drink. I leapt forward and jerked Victor away from the scattered feeder.
What the hell are you doing?
I demanded, shaking Victor hard. It was something I'd wanted to do for a long time.
Did you think you could drain him and become Strigoi right in front of us?
Hardly, said Victor, wincing at the grip I had on him.
That's not what he was doing, said Lyssa. He just lost control for a second.
His bloodlust satisfied, Victor's smooth demeanor had returned.
Ah, Vasilisa, always so understanding.
Don't make any assumptions, she growled.
I shot glares at both of them. We have to go, now. I turned to the compelled guardian. Take us to the room where they monitor all security footage. He didn't respond to me, and with a sigh, I looked expectantly at Lyssa. She repeated my question, and he immediately began to leave the room. My adrenaline was running high from the fight, and I was anxious to finish all of this and get us out of here. Through the bond, I sensed her nervousness. She might have defended Victor's need for blood, but as we walked, she kept as far away from him as possible. The stark realization of who he was and what we were doing was creeping up on her. I wished I could comfort her, but there was no time. We followed the guardian. Lyssa asked his name. It was Giovanni, through more halls and security checkpoints. The route he led us on went around the prison's edge, not through the cells. I held my breath almost the entire time, terrified we'd run into someone. Too many other factors were working against us. We didn't need that, too. Our luck held, though, and we ran into no one. Again, probably a result of doing this near the end of the night and not passing through a high security zone. Lyssa and Mia had gotten the court guardian to erase the security footage there, too, but I hadn't witnessed it. Now when Giovanni led us into the prison surveillance room, I couldn't help a small gasp. Monitors covered the walls, and consoles with complex buttons and switches sat in front of them. Computer-covered desks were everywhere. I felt like this room had the power to blast off into space. Everything in the prison was in view. Each cell, several halls, and even the warden's office, where Eddie sat making small talk with Theo. Two other guardians were in here, and I wondered if they'd seen us in the halls. But no, they were too fixated on something else. A camera that had been turned to face a blank wall. It was the one I'd adjusted in the feeding room. They were leaning toward it, and one of them was saying how they should call someone to check down there. Then they both looked up and noticed us.
Help her subdue them, Lyssa ordered Giovanni.
Again, there was hesitation. We would have been better off with a helper with a weaker will, but Lyssa had had no idea when she chose him. Like before, he eventually sprang into action. Also like before, surprise went a long way in subduing these two guardians. I was a stranger, immediately raising their guard, but still appeared as human. Giovanni was their co-worker. They didn't expect an attack from him. That didn't make them easy to take down, though. Having backup went a long way, and Giovanni was good at his job. We rendered one guardian unconscious pretty quickly, Giovanni using a chokehold to briefly cut off the guy's air until he collapsed. The other guard kept his distance from us, and I noticed his eyes continually shifting toward one of the walls. It had a fire extinguisher, a light switch, and a round silver button.
"That's an alarm!" exclaimed Victor, just as the guardian lunged for it.
Giovanni and I tackled him at the same time, stopping the guy just before his hand could brush the button and send a legion of guards down on us. A blow to the head knocked this guardian out, too. With each person I took out in this prison break, a knot of guilt and nausea twisted tighter and tighter in my stomach. Guardians were the good guys, and I couldn't help but keep thinking I was fighting on the side of evil. Now that we were left to ourselves, listen to the next step.
Giovanni, disable all the cameras and erase the last hour's worth of footage.
There was a greater hesitation on his part this time. Getting him to fight his friends had required a lot of forceful compulsion on her part. She was keeping her control, but growing weary, and it was only going to get harder making him obey our commands.
Do it,
growled Victor, coming to stand beside Lissa. She flinched at his proximity, but as his gaze joined hers, Giovanni complied with the order and began flipping switches on the consoles. Victor couldn't match Lissa's power by a long shot, but his small burst of compulsion had strengthened hers. One by one, the monitors went black, and then Giovanni typed in a few commands on the computer that stored digital footage from the cameras. Red arrow lights were flashing on the consoles, but there was no one here now to fix them.
Even if he erases it, there are those who might be able to recover it from the hard drive, noted Victor.
It's a chance we'll have to take, I said irritably. Reprogramming or whatever isn't really in my skill set. Victor rolled his eyes.
Perhaps, but destruction certainly is.
It took me a moment to get what he meant, but then it clicked. With a sigh, I grabbed the fire extinguisher from the wall and beat the computer to a pulp until it was nothing more than a pile of plastic and metal fragments. Lissa winced at each blow and kept glancing at the door.
I hope that's soundproof, she muttered.
It looks sturdy, I said confidently. And now it's time to go. Lissa ordered Giovanni to return us to the warden's office at the front of the prison. He complied, leading us back through the maze we'd gone through earlier. His codes and security card got us through each checkpoint.
I don't suppose you can compel Theo into letting us walk out, I asked Lissa.
Her mouth was set in a grim line. She shook her head.
I don't even know how much longer I can hold Giovanni. I've never used someone as a puppet before.
It's okay, I said, trying to reassure both of us. We're almost done with this. But we were going to have another fight on our hands. After beating up half the Strigoi in Russia, I still felt good about my own strength, but that guilty feeling wouldn't leave me. And if we ran into a dozen guardians, even my strength wasn't going to hold. I'd lost my bearings from the blueprint, but it turned out that Giovanni's route back to the main office was taking us through a block of cells after all. Another sign read overhead. Warning. Now entering prisoner area. Psychiatric.
Psychiatric?
I asked in surprise.
Of course, murmured Victor. Where else do you think they send prisoners with mental problems?
To hospitals? I responded, holding back a joke about all criminals having mental problems.
Well, that's not always.
Stop! Lissa interrupted him and came to an abrupt halt before the door. The rest of us nearly walked into her. She jerked away, taking several steps back.
What's wrong?
I asked. She turned to Giovanni.
Find another way to the office.
This is the fastest way, he argued.
Lissa slowly shook her head.
I don't care. Find another. One where we won't run into others.
He frowned, but her compulsion held. He abruptly turned, and we scurried to keep up.
What's wrong? I repeated.
Lissa's mind was too tangled for me to pull out her reasoning. She grimaced.
I felt spirit auras behind there.
What? How many?
At least two. I don't know if they sensed me or not.
If not for Giovanni's clip and the urgency pressing on us, I would have come to a stop.
Spirit users?
Lissa had looked so long and hard for others like her. Who'd have thought we'd find them here? Actually, maybe we should have expected this. We knew spirit users danced with insanity. Why wouldn't they end up in a place like this? And considering the trouble we'd gone through to learn about the prison, it was no wonder these spirit users had remained hidden. I doubted anyone working here even knew what they were. Lissa and I exchanged brief glances. I knew how badly she wanted to investigate this, but now wasn't the time. Victor already looked too interested in what we'd said, so Lissa's next words were in my head.
I'm pretty sure any spirit users would see through my charms. We can't risk our real descriptions being discovered, even if they came from people who are allegedly crazy.
I nodded my understanding, pushing aside curiosity and even regret. We'd have to check into this another time, say like the next time we decided to break into a maximum security prison. We finally reached Theo's office without further incident, though my heart pounded furiously the entire way as my brain kept telling me, "Go! Go! Go!" Theo and Eddie were chatting court politics when our group entered. Eddie immediately leapt up and went for Theo, recognizing it was time to go. He had Theo in a chokehold, as efficiently as Giovanni had managed earlier, and I was glad someone else was doing this dirty work besides me. Unfortunately, Theo managed a good yelp before passing out and falling to the ground. Immediately, the two guardians who had escorted us in earlier charged the office. Eddie and I jumped into the fray, and Lissa and Victor got Giovanni in on it too. To make things more difficult, just after we subdued one of the guardians, Giovanni broke out of the compulsion and began fighting against us. Worse, he ran to the wall where I discovered, too late, there was another silver alarm button. He slammed his fist against it, and a piercing wail filled the air. "Shit!" I yelled. Lissa's skills weren't in physical fighting, and Victor wasn't much better. It was all on me and Eddie to finish these last two, and we had to do it fast. The second of the escort guardians went down, and then it was just us and Giovanni. He got a good hit in on me, one that knocked my head against the wall. It wasn't good enough to make me pass out, but the world spun and black and white spots danced before my eyes. It froze me up for a moment, but then Eddie was on him, and Giovanni was soon no longer a threat. Eddie took my arm to steady me, and then the four of us immediately ran out of the room. I glanced back at the unconscious bodies, again hating myself for it. There was no time for guilt, though. We had to get out. Now. Every guardian in this prison would be here in less than a minute. Our group ran to the front doors, only to discover them locked from the inside. Eddie swore and told us to wait. He ran back to Theo's office and returned with one of the security cards that Giovanni had often swiped at the doors. Sure enough, this one let us out, and we made a mad dash for the rental car. We piled in, and I was glad Victor kept up with all of us and made none of his annoying comments. Eddie stepped on the gas and headed back toward the way we'd come in. I sat beside him in the front. "I guarantee the gate guy's going to know about the alarm," I warned. Our original hope had been to simply leave and tell him there'd been a paperwork mix-up after all.
"Yep,"
Eddie agreed, face hard. Sure enough, the guardian stepped out of his gatehouse, arms waving. "Is that a gun?" I exclaimed.
"I'm not stopping to find out."
Eddie pushed hard on the gas, and when the guardian realized we were coming through regardless, he jumped out of the way. We crashed through the wooden arm that blocked the road, leaving it a mess of splinters. "Bud's gonna keep our deposit," I said. Behind us, I heard the sounds of gunshots. Eddie swore again, but as we sped away, the shots grew fainter, and soon we were out of range. He exhaled.
"If those had hit our tires or windows, we'd have had a lot more to worry about than a deposit."
"They're going to send people after us," said Victor from the back seat.
Once again, Lissa had moved as far from him as she could.
"Trucks are probably leaving right now."
"You don't think we guessed that?" I snapped. I knew he was trying to be helpful, but he was the last person I wanted to hear from at the moment. Even as I spoke, I peered back and saw the dark shapes of two vehicles speeding down the road after us. They were gaining quickly, leaving no question that the SUVs would soon catch up to our little compact car. I looked at our GPS.
"We need to turn soon,"
I warned Eddie, not that he needed my advice. We'd mapped out an escape route beforehand, one that took lots and lots of twisty turns on these remote back roads. Fortunately, there were a lot of them. Eddie made a hard left and then almost an immediate right. Still, the pursuing vehicle stayed with us in the rearview mirror,
It wasn't until a few turns later that the road behind us stayed clear. Tense silence filled the car as we waited for the guardians to catch up. They didn't. We'd made too many confusing turns, but it took nearly 10 minutes for me to accept that we might have actually pulled this off.
"I think we lost them," said Eddie,
the wonder in his voice matching my feelings. His face was still lined with worry, his hands gripping the wheel hard.
"We won't lose them until we clear Fairbanks," I said. "I'm sure they'll search it, and it's not that big."
"Where are we going?" asked Victor. "If I'm allowed to ask." I squirmed around in my seat so that I could look him in the eye.
"That's what you're going to tell us. As hard as it is to believe, we didn't do all that just because we missed your pleasant company."
"That is hard to believe." I narrowed my eyes.
"We want to find your brother, Robert Drew."
I had the satisfaction of momentarily catching Victor off guard. Then his sly look returned.
"Of course. This is a follow-up to Abe Mazur's request, isn't it? I should have known he wouldn't take no for an answer. Of course, I never would have guessed you were in league with him."
Victor apparently didn't know I was actually in the familial league with Abe, and I wasn't about to enlighten him.
"Irrelevant," I said coldly. "Now you're going to take us to Robert. Where is he?"
"You forget, Rose," mused Victor. "You aren't the one with compulsion here."
"No, but I'm the one who can tie you up by the side of the road and make an anonymous call back to the prison with your whereabouts.
How do I know you won't get what you want from me and then turn me back in anyway?" he asked. "I have no reason to trust you."
"You're right. I sure as hell wouldn't trust me. But if things work out, there's a chance we might let you go afterward."
"No, there really wasn't."
"Is this something you want to gamble on?"
"You'll never get another opportunity like this, and you know it."
Victor had no witty quip for that.
Score another one for me.
"So," I continued, "are you going to take us to him or not?"
Thoughts I couldn't read churned behind his eyes.
No doubt he was scheming about how he could work this to his advantage, probably figuring out how to escape us before we even reached Robert. It was what I would have done.
"Las Vegas," Victor said at last. "We need to go to Las Vegas."
Chapter 8.
After the bitching I'd done to Abe about always going to remote, crappy places, I should have been excited about the prospect of going to Sin City. Alas, I had a few reservations about my next epic trip. First of all, somewhere like Las Vegas was the last place I would expect a semi-crazy recluse to be. From the bits and pieces I'd heard, Robert had dropped off the radar and wanted to be alone. A busy, tourist-filled city didn't really fit that description. Second, cities like that were perfect feeding grounds for Strigoi. Crowded, reckless, low inhibitions, very easy for people to disappear, especially when most of them were out at night. Part of me was certain it had to be a trick on Victor's part, but he swore up and down that it was true. So, with no other leads, Las Vegas became our next destination. We didn't have much time to debate the matter anyway, knowing the guardians would be searching Fairbanks for us. Admittedly, Lissa's charms had altered our appearances enough that they wouldn't be looking for people with our descriptions. They knew what Victor looked like, though, so the sooner we were out of Alaska, the better. Unfortunately, we had a slight problem.
"Victor has no ID," said Eddie. "We can't take him on a plane."
It was true. All of Victor's possessions had been seized by prison authorities, and in the midst of disabling surveillance and taking out half a dozen guardians, we'd hardly had time to go searching for his personal stuff. Lissa's compulsion was phenomenal, but she was exhausted after wheeling so much at the prison. Besides, guardians would likely be watching the airport. Our friend Bud, the car rental guy, provided the solution. He hadn't been thrilled to see his car returned with all the scratches from Eddie's daredevil driving, but enough cash had finally stopped the humans muttering about renting to a bunch of kids. It was Victor who thought of an alternative plan and suggested it to Bud.
"Is there a private airport nearby with flights we might charter?"
"Sure," said Bud. "But it won't be cheap."
"It's not an issue. I said. Bud eyed us askance.
Did you guys rob a bank or something?
No, but we were packing a lot of currency. Lissa had a trust fund that doled her out monthly money until she was 18, as well as a high-limit credit card. I had a credit card of my own, left over from when I'd sweet-talked Adrian into funding my Russian trip. I'd let go of the rest of my assets, like the huge bank account he'd set up. But wrong or not, I'd decided to keep one card on hand, just in case of emergency. This was certainly an emergency, so we used the card to pay for part of the private plane's cost. The pilot couldn't take us as far as Las Vegas, but he could take us to Seattle, where he was able to connect us with another pilot he knew who could go the rest of the way. More money. In Seattle again, I mused, just before the plane took off. The little jet's interior had a set of four seats, two on each side facing each other. I sat next to Victor, and Eddie sat across from him. We figured that was the best protective configuration.
What about Seattle?
Asked Eddie, puzzled. Never mind. Little private jets aren't nearly as fast as big commercial ones, and our trip took a large part of the day. During it, I continued asking Victor about his brother's role in Las Vegas and finally got the answer I wanted. Victor would have had to tell us eventually, but I think he'd gotten a sadistic thrill out of prolonging the answer.
Robert doesn't live in Las Vegas proper, he explained. He has a small house, a cabin, I suppose, out by Red Rock Canyon, miles outside the city.
Ah, now that was more what I'd expected. Lissa stiffened at the mention of a cabin, and I felt unease through the bond. When Victor had kidnapped her, he'd taken her to a cabin in the woods and tortured her there. I gave her as reassuring a look as I could. It was times like these I wished the bond worked both ways so that I could truly send her comfort.
So we'll go out there?
Victor snorted.
Certainly not. Robert values his privacy too much. He wouldn't let strangers come to his home. But he'll come to the city if I ask.
Lissa eyed me. Victor could be setting us up. He had lots of supporters. Now that he's out, he could call them instead of Robert to meet us. I gave her a tiny nod, again wishing I could respond back through the bond. I thought of this as well. It was imperative we never leave Victor alone to make unsupervised calls. And actually, this plan to meet in Las Vegas itself made me feel better. For our own safety from Victor's henchmen, it was better to be in the city than out in the middle of nowhere.
Seeing as I've been so helpful, said Victor, I have the right to know what you want with my brother.
He glanced at Lissa.
Looking for spirit lessons?
You had to have done some excellent investigative work to find out about him. You have no right to know about our plans, I retorted sharply. And seriously, if you're keeping track of who's been the most helpful here, we are totally beating you on the scorecard. You've got a ways to go to catch up after what we did at Tarasov.
Victor's only response was a small smile. Some of our flight time took place at night, which meant it was early morning when we landed in Las Vegas. The safety of sunlight. I was surprised to see how crowded the airport was. The private one in Seattle had had a fair amount of planes, but the Fairbanks airport had nearly been deserted. This strip was chock full of little jets, many of them screaming luxury. I shouldn't have been surprised. Las Vegas was the playground of celebrities and other wealthy people, many of whom probably couldn't lower themselves to fly commercial with ordinary passengers. There were taxis there, sparing us the ordeal of another rental car. But when the driver asked us where we were going, we all stayed silent. I turned to Victor.
The middle of the city, right? The strip?
Yes, he agreed.
He'd been certain Robert would want to meet strangers somewhere very public, somewhere he could easily flee.
The strip's a big place, said the driver. You got any place in particular, or should I just drop you off in the middle of the street?
Silence fell over us. Lissa shot me a meaningful look.
The witching hour?
I considered it. Las Vegas was a favorite place for some Maroi. The bright sun made it less appealing for Strigoi, and the windowless casinos created comfortable, dark atmospheres. The Witching Hour was a hotel and casino we'd all heard of. While it had plenty of human customers, it was actually owned by Maroi, so it had lots of clandestine features to make it a great getaway for vampires. Theaters in back rooms,
Special Maroi only lounges. A fair number of guardians on patrol. Guardians. I shook my head and glanced sideways at Victor. We can't take him there. Of all the hotels in Las Vegas, the witching hour was the last we'd want to go to. Victor's escape had to be breaking news all over the Maroi world. Taking him into Vegas's largest concentration of Maroi and guardians was probably the worst thing we could do at this point. In the rearview mirror, the driver's face looked impatient. It was Eddie who finally piped up.
The Luxor.
He and I were in the back seat, with Victor between us, and I peered over.
Where did that come from? It puts distance between us and the witching hour.
Eddie suddenly looked a little sheepish.
And I've always wanted to stay there. I mean, if you're coming to Vegas, why not stay in a pyramid?
You can't fault that logic, said Lissa.
The Luxor it is, I said to the driver.
We rode in silence, all of us, well, except for Victor, staring at the sights in awe. Even in the daytime, the streets of Las Vegas were teeming with people. The young and glamorous walked side by side with older couples from Middle America, who'd probably saved and saved to make this trip. The hotels and casinos we passed were huge, flashy, and inviting. And when we reached the Luxor, yup, it was just like Eddie had said. A hotel shaped like a pyramid. I stared up at it when we got out of the car, trying hard not to let my jaw drop like the starry-eyed tourist I was. I paid the driver and we headed inside. I didn't know how long we'd be staying, but we definitely needed a room as our base of operation. Stepping into the hotel was like being in the nightclubs in St. Petersburg and Novosibirsk. Flashing lights and the overwhelming scent of smoke. And noise. Noise, noise, noise. The slot machines beeped and rang, chips fell, people yelled in dismay or delight, and the low thrum of conversation filled the room like humming bees. I grimaced. The stimuli grated on my senses. We passed through the casino's edge to get to the front desk, where the attendant didn't even blink at three teenagers and an old man getting a room together. I had to imagine that around here, they saw it all. Our room was average size, with two double beds, and somehow we'd lucked out with an amazing view. Lissa stood at the window, entranced by the sights of people and cars on the strip below. But I jumped straight to business.
Okay, call him, I ordered Victor.
He'd settled down on one of the beds, hands crossed and expression serene, as though he truly were on vacation. Despite that smug smile, I could see the fatigue etched on his face. Even with his blood refill, the escape and long trip had been exhausting, and the effects of his slowly returning disease were naturally taking a toll on his physical strength. Victor immediately reached for the hotel's phone, but I shook my head. Liss, let him use your cell. I want a record of this number. She gingerly handed the phone over, as though he might contaminate it. He took it and gave me a nigh angelic look. I don't suppose I could have some privacy. It's been so long since Robert and I have talked.
No,
I snapped. The harshness in my voice startled even me. And it occurred to me Lissa wasn't the only one suffering from all the spirit used today. Victor gave a small shrug and began dialing. He'd told us on one of the flights that he had Robert's number memorized, and I had to take it on faith that that was who he was calling. I also had to hope Robert's number hadn't changed. Of course, even Victor hadn't seen his brother in years. Victor had only been imprisoned a short while and had probably kept tabs on Robert beforehand. Tension filled the room as we waited while the phone rang. A moment later, I heard a voice answer through the phone speaker, though I couldn't make out the exact words. Robert, said Victor pleasantly. It's Victor. This received a frantic response on the other end. I only could hear half of the conversation. But it was intriguing. Victor first had to spend a lot of time convincing Robert that he was out of prison. Apparently, Robert wasn't so removed from Maroi society that he was out of touch with current news. Victor told him that the details would be revealed later, and then began making his pitch for Robert to come meet us. It took a long time. I got the feeling that Robert lived in fear and paranoia, which reminded me of Ms. Karp when she'd been in the advanced stages of Spirit's insanity.
Lissa's gaze stayed fixed on the scene outside the window during the entire call, but her feelings mirrored mine. Fear that this could someday be her fate, or mine as well, if I siphoned away Spirit's effects. The image of the Tarasov sign flashed briefly through her mind. Warning, now entering prisoner area, psychiatric. Victor's voice turned surprisingly cajoling as he spoke to his brother, gentle even. I was reminded uneasily of the old days, before we'd known about Victor's demented plans for Maroi domination. Back then, he'd treated us kindly too, and had practically been a member of Lissa's family. I wondered if at some point he'd been sincere, or if it had all been an act. Finally, after almost 20 minutes, Victor convinced Robert to come see us. The unintelligible words on the other end of the phone were filled with anxiety, and at this point, I felt convinced that Victor truly was talking to his crazy brother and not one of his accomplices. Victor set up a dinner meeting at one of the hotel's restaurants and at last disconnected. "Dinner?" I asked when Victor set the phone down. "Isn't he worried about being out after dark?" "It's an early dinner," Victor replied. 4:30, and the sun won't go down until almost 8.
4:30? I asked. "Good God, are we getting the senior citizen special?"
But he made a good point about the time and sun. Without the safety of Alaska's nearly non-stop summer light, I was starting to feel suffocated by the pressure of sunrise and sunset boundaries, even though it was summer here. Unfortunately, a safe early dinner still meant we had hours to pass. Victor leaned back on the bed, arms behind his head. I think he was attempting an unconcerned air, but my guess was that it was actually exhaustion driving him to seek the bed's comfort.
"Care to try your luck downstairs?"
He glanced over at Lissa.
"Spirit users make remarkably good card players. I don't have to tell you how good you are at reading people."
She made no response.
"Nobody's leaving this room," I said.
I didn't like the idea of us all being cooped up here, but I couldn't risk an escape attempt or Strigoi lurking in the casino's dark corners. After showering the dye from her hair, Lissa pulled up a chair by the window. She refused to get any closer to Victor. I sat cross-legged on the second bed, where there was plenty of room for Eddie to sit too, but he remained upright against a wall, in perfect guardian posture, as he watched Victor. I had no doubt Eddie could maintain that position for hours, no matter how uncomfortable it got. We'd all been trained to endure harsh conditions. He did a good job at looking stern, but every once in a while, I'd catch him studying Victor curiously. Eddie had stood by me in this act of treason, but still didn't know why I'd done it. We'd been there a few hours when someone knocked at the door. I leapt up. Eddie and I mirrored each other, both of us straightening to rigid attention, hands going for our steaks. We'd ordered lunch an hour ago, but room service had long since come and gone. It was too early for Robert, and besides, he didn't know the name our room was under. There was no nausea, though. No Strigoi at our door. I met Eddie's gaze, silent messages passing between us on what to do. But it was Lissa who first acted, rising from her chair, taking a few steps across the room.
"It's Adrian!"
"What?"
I exclaimed.
"Are you sure?"
She nodded. Spirit users usually saw auras, but they could sense each other if they were close enough, just as she had at the prison. Still, none of us moved. She gave me a dry look.
"He knows I'm here," she pointed out.
"He can feel me, too."
I sighed, still keeping my hand on my steak, and strode toward the door. I squinted through the peephole. Standing there, his expression amused and restless, was Adrian. I could see no one else, and with no indication of Strigoi to be found, I finally opened the door. His face lit with joy when he saw me. Leaning in, he gave me a quick kiss on the cheek before stepping into the room.
"You guys didn't really think you could go off on a party weekend without me, did you? Especially here, of all places."
He froze, and it was one of those rare moments when Adrian Ivashkov was caught totally and completely off guard.
"Did you know," he said slowly, "that Victor Dashkov is sitting on your bed?"
"Yeah," I said. It was kind of a shock to us, too. Adrian dragged his gaze from Victor and glanced around the room, noticing Eddie for the first time.
Eddie had been standing so still that he practically seemed like part of the furniture. Adrian turned to me.
What the hell is going on?
Everyone is out looking for him.
Liz's words spoke to me through my bond.
You might as well tell him. You know he won't leave now.
She was right. I didn't know how Adrian had found us, but now that he had, there was no way he'd go. I glanced, hesitantly, at Eddie, who guessed my thoughts.
We'll be fine, he said. Go talk. I won't let anything happen.
And I'm strong enough again that I can compel him if he tries anything, Lissa added.
I sighed. Okay, we'll be right back. I took Adrian's arm and led him outside. As soon as we were in the hallway, he started in again.
Rose, what's?
I shook my head. In our time here, I'd heard enough noise from other hotel guests in the hall to know that my friends would hear our conversation if we talked out there. Instead, Adrian and I took the elevator and headed downstairs, where the noise of the casino would mask our words. We found a slightly out-of-the-way corner, and Adrian practically pushed me against the wall, his expression dark. His light attitude annoyed me sometimes, but I preferred it to when he was upset, largely because I feared Spirit would add an unstable edge.
You leave me a note saying you're sneaking off for one last party weekend, and instead I find you holed up with one of the most notorious criminals ever. When I left court, that's all everyone was talking about. Didn't that guy try to kill you?
I answered his question with a question.
How did you even find us?
The credit card, he said. I was waiting for you to use it.
My eyes widened.
You promised me when I got all those that you wouldn't go snooping.
Since my accounts and cards had come with his help, I'd known he had access to the records, but I believed him when he'd said he'd respect my privacy.
When you were in Russia, I kept that promise. This is different. I kept checking and checking with the company, and as soon as the activity with the charter plane showed up, I called and found out where you were going.
Adrian's arrival here, so soon after ours, wasn't that unbelievable, if he had been monitoring the card. Once he'd had the information he needed, he could have easily booked a flight. A non-stop commercial jet would have made up the time on our slower, multi-stop trip.
There was no way I could resist Vegas, he continued. So I thought I'd surprise you and show up to join in the fun.
I'd used my card for the room, I realized, again tipping off our location. No one else was linked to my or Lissa's cards, but the ease with which he'd tracked us made me nervous.
You shouldn't have done that, I growled. We might be together, but there are boundaries you've got to respect. This is none of your business.
It's not like I was reading your diary. I just wanted to find my girlfriend, and...
It was a sign of Adrian's distress that his mind was only now beginning to backtrack and put pieces together.
Oh, Lord. Rose, please tell me you guys aren't the ones who busted him out. They're all looking for two human girls and a Dompierre guy. The descriptions don't match at all, he groaned. But it was you, wasn't it? Somehow you broke into a maximum security prison. With Eddie.
Must not have been all that secure, I remarked lightly.
Rose, this guy has fucked with both of your lives. Why would you free him?
Because, I hesitated. How could I explain that which, by all evidence in our world, was impossible? And how could I explain what goal in particular was driving this? Victor has information we need, or, well, he has access to someone we need. This was the only way we could get it.
What on earth could he possibly know to make you do all this?
I swallowed. I walked into prisons and nests of Strigoi, but saying what I did next to Adrian filled me with apprehension. Because there might be a way to save Strigoi, to turn them back to the way they were. And Victor knows someone who might have done this. Adrian stared at me for several long seconds. And even in the midst of the casino's movement and noise, it was like the world grew still and silent.
Rose, that's impossible.
It might not be.
If there was a way to do that, we would know.
It involves spirit users, and we only just found out about them.
That doesn't mean it's...
Oh, I see. His deep green eyes flashed, and this time, they were angry.
It's him, isn't it? This is your last crazy attempt to get to him, to Dimitri.
Not just him, I said vaguely. It could save Ostrogoy.
I thought this was over,
Adrian exclaimed. His voice was loud enough that a few people at nearby slot machines glanced over.
You told me it was over. You told me you could move on and be with me.
I meant it, I said, surprised at the desperate note in my voice. It's something we only just found out about. We had to try.
And what then? What if this stupid fantasy works? You free Dimitri in some miraculous act, and you drop me like that?
He snapped his fingers. I don't know, I said wearily. We're just taking this one step at a time. I love being with you, really, but I can't ignore this.
Of course you can't.
He turned his eyes heavenward.
Dreams, dreams. I walk them. I live them. I delude myself with them. It's a wonder I can spot reality anymore.
The weird sound of his voice made me nervous. I could recognize one of his slightly crazy spirit-induced lapses. Then, he turned from me with a sigh.
I need a drink.
Whatever pity I'd felt for him turned to anger.
Oh, good. That'll fix everything. I'm glad in a world gone mad, you've still got your old standbys.
I flinched at his glare. He didn't do it very often. And when he did, it was a powerful thing.
What do you expect me to do?
He asked.
You could...
Oh, God.
Well, now that you're here, you could help us. Plus, this guy we're meeting, he's another spirit user.
Adrian didn't betray his thoughts, but I had a feeling that I had piqued his interest.
Yeah, that's exactly what I want. To help my girlfriend get her old boyfriend back.
He turned away again, and I heard him mutter,
I need two drinks.
4:30, I called after him. We're meeting at 4:30. There was no response, and Adrian melted into the crowd. I returned to the room in a dark cloud that had to be obvious to everyone. Lissa and Eddie were smart enough not to ask questions, but Victor, of course, had no such reserves.
What? Mr. Ivashkov isn't joining us? I'd been so looking forward to his company.
Shut up,
I said, crossing my arms and leaning against the wall near Eddie. Don't speak unless you're spoken to. The next couple hours dragged by. I was convinced that any minute Adrian would come back and reluctantly agree to help us. We could use his compulsion if things went bad, even though he couldn't match Lissa. Surely he loved me enough to come to my aid. He wouldn't abandon me. You're an idiot, Rose. It was my own voice that chastised me in my head, not Lissa's. You've given him no reason to help. You just hurt him again and again, just like you did Mason. When 4:15 came around, Eddie looked over at me.
Should we stake out a table?
Yeah. I was restless and upset. I didn't want to stay in this room any longer. Trapped with dark feelings that wouldn't go away. Victor rose from the bed, stretching as though getting up from a relaxing nap. Still, I could have sworn there was an eager glint hidden in the depths of his eyes. By all accounts, he and his half-brother were close, though I'd seen no indication that Victor displayed love or loyalty to anyone. Who knew? Maybe somewhere there was true affection for Robert. We formed a sort of protective configuration with me in the front, Eddie in the back, and the two Maroi between us. I opened the room's door and came face to face with Adrian. His hand was raised as though he'd been about to knock. He arched an eyebrow.
Oh, hey,
he said. He had the standard laid-back Adrian expression on his face, though his voice was a bit strained. I knew he wasn't happy about any of this. I could see it in the tight set of his jaw and agitation in his eyes. Nonetheless, he was putting on a good front for the others, for which I was grateful. Most importantly, he'd come back. That was what mattered, and I could ignore the scent of alcohol and smoke wreathing him.
So, I hear there's some party going on. Mind if I join you?
I gave him a weak,
grateful smile. Come on. Our group, now up to 5, we headed down the hall toward the elevator.
I was cleaning up at poker, you know, Adrian added. So this better be good.
I don't know if it'll be good, I mused. The elevator doors opened. But I think it'll be memorable. We stepped inside, off to see Robert Tarrou, and what might be Dimitri's only salvation. Chapter 9 Robert Tarrou was easy to spot. It wasn't because he looked like Victor. It wasn't even because of any dramatic running-toward-each-other reunion-type thing between him and his brother. Rather, it was Liz's mind that tipped me off. I saw Robert through her eyes, the golden aura of a spirit user lighting up his corner of the restaurant like a star. It caught her by surprise, and she stumbled briefly. Spirit users were too rare a sight for her to be fully used to them. Seeing auras was something she could tune in or out. But just before turning his off, she noted that even though his had the brilliant gold she saw in Adrian, there was also a feel of instability to it. Sparks of other colors flashed there too, but they trembled and flickered. She wondered if it was a mark of spirit's insanity setting in. His eyes lit up as Victor approached the table, but the two didn't hug or touch. Victor simply sat down beside his brother. The rest of us stood there awkwardly for a moment. The whole situation was too weird. But it was the reason we'd come, and after several more seconds, my friends and I joined the brothers at the table.
Victor! Breathed Robert, eyes wide.
Robert might have had some of the Dashkov facial features, but his eyes were brown, not green. His hands toyed with a napkin.
I can't believe it!